Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. A little bit later, we'll be talking about some of the secrets of the past that archaeologists found during construction of the new Mississippi River Bridge. But first, this is American Heart Month, the time when we are all encouraged to think about heart disease. That's because it's the nation's number one killer, and because there are many things we can do to help prevent it from killing us. From year to year, there are a lot of improvements and progress in the areas of prevention, diagnosis, and treatment for heart disease. And our guest on today's program can fill us in on all of it, as well as take your questions. He's been with us before, and it's a pleasure to welcome back Dr. Andrew Cates, Washington University cardiologist at Barnes Jewish Hospital and Washington University Cardiology Fellowship Program Director. Dr. Cates, nice to have you with us again.
It's great to be back. Thanks.
Well, given what the condition is outside, I think we'd better start with the obvious.
The snow.
How many people should be out there shoveling snow today?
You know, it's interesting, and we know that the death rates from heart disease do go up in the winter months, and you know, we'll talk more about snow shoveling in just a minute and the effects of cold. We know that cold can increase blood pressure, it can cause spasm in the coronary arteries and maybe cause those arteries to constrict. And then being out in the cold and some of the changes that can happen with exertion, such as shoveling the snow, can make things worse. Your heart rate can increase, your blood pressure can increase, and it can cause some stress on the arterial wall, and it can cause plaques to break loose and can result in a heart attack. And it's interesting. This has been looked at in several different studies. Most studies after cities have large snowfalls, and in several different cities, in Detroit after a large snowfall, in Virginia in one city after a large snowfall, several studies have shown that patients came in with heart attacks, and the number of people coming in after shoveling snow was fairly significant. Just for an example, there was a study in Detroit that looked at a large snowstorm in 1999 and showed that between 6 and 8 o'clock in the morning, 7 people presented to the emergency room with a heart attack, 5 of them after shoveling snow. And it's interesting, many of those people didn't have traditional risk factors like smoking, hypertension, or cholesterol, but the majority were inactive, so they didn't exercise. Why it happens, it's not entirely clear. It's thought that the cold can sometimes trigger spasm, as I said. There are some other effects that can happen too and cause platelets to stick together and cause the arteries to occlude suddenly. What we do know, there was actually one study that looked at the effects of the stress on snow shoveling. They took patients who weren't very active and had them shovel snow and measured what their heart rate did, what their blood pressure did. And it's the equivalent to doing a maximum stress test. So the effects of snow shoveling on the body are pretty much like doing a stress test. But when you do that stress test and shoveling snow, you're outside. So what we do think is that people who are inactive, people who are overweight, people that have risk factors really shouldn't be outside in the cold shoveling snow.
Thanks very much. I don't think I'll go outside again until the middle of April or so.
Be careful.
But it's related really to the physical condition as opposed to age and that sort of thing.
It is, right. I mean, in part at least. The majority of people in these studies were over age 60, but it tends to be people who are overweight, people who are not physically active, people – kind of the weekend warrior mentality, people that start to go out and exercise when they don't exercise regularly. These are people that tend to have more problems.
We've had a lot of very cold days recently, and you talk of cold being a factor. Mm-hmm. Is there a cutoff temperature where people really should limit the amount of exercise they get outside?
You know, we tell people to try to use decent judgment. There's no specific cutoff. I think a lot of it relates to kind of some comorbid conditions that people may have, again, related to inactivity and obesity and some other risk factors. I would certainly discourage people when it's less than freezing. If you have heart disease, then being out in the cold, typically temperatures less than freezing. And these days when the wind chill gets down well below zero, that's not smart to be outside for most anybody. One thing that's worth noting too, though, we do tell our patients, specifically those with coronary disease. I was talking again briefly about some of the studies that had looked at patients. There were several patients who had stents put in who came in with the stents clotting off suddenly in the setting of being out in the cold shoveling. So people with coronary disease certainly do need to be more careful than other folks.
Well, that's good advice because obviously heart disease is so prevalent these days.
It certainly is, right? We're doing our best to combat that, and that's obviously why we're here today and talking about with American Heart Month this February. The statistics are really pretty impressive, and we've talked about this over the years. If you look at cardiovascular disease, so approximately 84 million Americans, adult Americans, have cardiovascular disease, and about half of those are over age 60. the way heart disease or cardiovascular disease shows up, about 80 million Americans have hypertension. About 15 million have coronary heart disease, about 7 million having heart attacks, and 5 million having heart failure, and about 7 million having stroke. So really an overwhelming percentage of the population, about 1 out of 3 adults, have cardiovascular disease.
And we've talked about this before too, but an increasing number of these people are women, and that's relatively new.
And over the course of the last maybe 15 years or so, it's really become clear that more women than men die from cardiovascular disease. And it used to be, and the traditional teaching was that heart disease happened in men, but you know, clearly that's not the case now. And if we look at, you know, we talked about how common heart disease is. If we look at the number of people actually dying from cardiovascular disease, it's certainly staggering. 1 out of 3 deaths are attributed to cardiovascular disease. And if you look at those numbers, it makes about 2,000 people every day dying from cardiovascular disease. Very common, again, in men and women, but more women do die from cardiovascular disease.
And yet so much progress has been made, particularly in recent years, in dealing with this.
Right. It's true. And if we look, there's been a significant decrease in the number of people dying from cardiovascular disease and over the last 20 years or so. And that really does relate to advances we've made in understanding of cardiovascular disease, but also in understanding the importance of prevention and using evidence-based medicine and helping people reduce their risk. So by using medications that have been shown to be beneficial, but also importantly by risk factor modification with lifestyle changes and environmental changes also.
It's been a year since we last got together. Have there been any significant I hate to use the word breakthrough, but any discoveries?
Discoveries, there have been some important discoveries, but I think what's even more important are some of the new guidelines that have come out. And at the end of last year, in December, the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology came out with several new prevention guidelines, which I'm sure many people have heard of and heard about, relating to management of cholesterol, related to obesity, to risk factor assessment, and to lifestyle. And then just in January, the new hypertension guidelines came out. So breakthroughs in the sense of reevaluating how we treat patients and reassessing the appropriate ways to treat patients with a variety of different risk factors and treatable conditions as they relate to cardiovascular disease.
Can you give us some sense of those guidelines?
Well, sure. And we can start with the cholesterol guidelines. Good. So these came out just at the end of December and really focused on several different things. And as we think about this, some patients will kind of scratch their heads and say, well, wait a minute, were you lying to us before as things were readdressed? The things that came out from this, some of the key points, one is that we no longer look at numbers as far as assessing how we treat patients and try to treat their cholesterol. We're really looking more now at risk. So we're looking to see patients who are at risk for cardiovascular disease and deciding based upon their risk if they should be treated with medications to help help address their cholesterol. So rather than the importance of knowing your numbers, it's more now important to know what your risk is. And really 4 groups were identified in the new guidelines who should be treated with medications and specifically with statins to help reduce their risk of cardiovascular disease. So those patients who have atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, those are patients who benefit from being treated with statins. Those patients who are diabetics, those men and women between age 40 and 79 who have very high cholesterol levels, a bad cholesterol of over 190. And then another group, though, who based upon their risk profile, if their risk of a cardiovascular event is more than 7.5% over 10 years, those are patients also who should be treated. And actually, the recommendations are such, it's important to have this conversation with patients to decide if they want to be treated or not. So those are some of the key – there are several other changes too, but those are some of the key points that have come out.
And other guidelines?
Sure.
You mentioned?
So the blood pressure guidelines, and they've changed slightly also. And you know, with this has come some controversy, both with the cholesterol guidelines and with the hypertension guidelines. And controversy is probably the wrong term, some discussions that came out afterwards. With the hypertension guidelines, the major change that became recommended was changing the target blood pressure. For those individuals over age 60, formerly it was recommended that blood pressure be targeted to less than a systolic blood pressure. That's the top number of less than 140. Now what's recommended is targeting that pressure just to less than 150. We kind of fell into the trap that lower was better. And looking at the data that was available, the authors of the hypertension guidelines felt that lower blood pressure in older patients actually wasn't beneficial. But for those patients who are less than 60, targeting a blood pressure of less than 140 over 90 is still appropriate.
I thought 120 was the...
No. So, well, this is where if we look at it depends upon the data that you look at. And if it's observational data, so looking at studies or epidemiologic studies over time and seeing the risk of having a heart attack or stroke based upon your blood pressure as opposed to treating to targets. Mm-hmm. So when we look at studies that address treating to targets, the data suggests that lowering blood pressure just to less than 150 in our older patients is where the benefit is, that lowering it more than that isn't beneficial, and lowering it too much in older patients may actually be detrimental. And we've come to see that, that sometimes lower may not be better when it comes to blood pressure. Now, there is some controversy with that, and actually a few weeks or so after the hypertension guidelines came out, some of the co-authors of the hypertension guidelines had kind of a rebuttal paper that came out saying that there's still some controversy with that, which makes it difficult for clinicians but also certainly for patients to say, you know, to say where are we now.
I was just going to – sorry to interrupt. Okay. I was just going to suggest that most people have no idea what their blood pressure is.
That's right. And this is where it's important, obviously, to know what your numbers are, to know what the risk factors are also. And let me – I want to address one other thing, though, and then we'll talk a little bit about risk factors. When it comes to – with cholesterol, and people may say, well, wait a minute. You told me before I had to know my numbers. Lower was better. Now, why are you changing things? Were we wrong before? And it's not that we were wrong before. It's just that in reassessing and looking at the totality of the data that's available, we reassessed it. And we said, you know what? We were doing things well before, but this is better. We're reassessing the way we do things. And it wasn't that we were wrong. When it comes to risk factors, though, you just mentioned knowing what your blood pressure is and knowing what your cholesterol is. It's important to know what the risk factors are because by far the risk of having a heart attack or stroke really is related to treatable and preventable risk factors. If it's hypertension, if it's diabetes, cholesterol, smoking, obesity, or physical inactivity, certainly knowing your family history is important also. But it is really knowing that if you have those risk factors, then you are at increased risk, and there's things that you can do about it.
Yeah. You mentioned family history, and I've seen and observed on many occasions when people have suffered heart attacks that there generally is a family history of that. It seems to be quite prevalent.
Yeah. What's interesting with family history, and it's always helpful to define just what a family history is as it relates to your risk of having a cardiovascular event. So family history in general means premature cardiovascular disease. So if it's a first-degree relative, your parent or sibling, if it's a male first-degree relative before age 55 or a female first-degree relative before age 65, that's considered premature. You know, many people, as we talked before with the statistics, most people die from cardiovascular disease. So if you're in your 80s or 90s, it's going to get to you. But so that doesn't affect your individual risk. So it's important to understand that what's challenging with family history is it's kind of that black box. We don't know how it specifically affects your risk for you as an individual. It may increase your risk for cardiovascular disease. It may increase your susceptibility to having hypertension, to having high cholesterol, to the effects of smoking. So that family history becomes important, but it's not clear, always clear for you specifically. And we're actually looking at this in patients with premature atherosclerosis. We're trying to identify specific markers for them of increased risk. Several people I'm working with over at WashU.
I'm curious about the disparity in the age. You mentioned women 65, men 55. More women are dying of heart attacks than men these days, and we've just talked about how this is increasing.
Right. And in general, it's thought to be that disparity in age or the delay in onset in women seems to be from the protective effects of estrogen. So before women go through menopause, there are protective effects that estrogen exerts on the body in various different ways that helps prevent the occurrence of cardiovascular disease early on. What's interesting, though, and as we look at the manifestations of cardiovascular disease in men and women, that seems to be different also. Women seem to be more at risk for stroke as opposed to men being more at risk for heart attacks.
I want to advise our audience that the lines are now open. If you'd like to get into this discussion with Dr. Andrew Cates, please do so at 382-8255. That's with an area code of 314, of course. You can also email us at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. Okay, now back to our discussion about heart disease. Were there other risk factors you wanted to mention, or should we move on to another part of this discussion?
We can move on.
Sugar.
Sure.
Sugar.
Well, they're taking away all of our fun, aren't
Boy.
They? My wife and children are now clinically depressed. I know you're talking about the study that just came out yesterday that looked at the effects of sugar on cardiovascular risk. This is interesting, and I looked at this just yesterday, and what this study was, and I'm sure many of listeners have heard about it. There was a study from the Centers for Disease Control that looked at a very large database called the NHANES database, which is the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey database, and they looked at the amount of sugar consumed daily by Americans, and then they looked at the effects of that on cardiovascular disease. And they found several different things. When they found that the amount of dietary calories or daily calories from sugar grew from about 15% to about 17% from 1988 through 2004. And it was about 15% in 2005. They found that about 7 out of 10 adults in the U.S. get more than 10% of their calories from sugar, and that about 1 out of 10 get about 25% of their calories from sugar. But importantly, what they found and what's really made the news was a strong association between the amount of added sugar in the diet and cardiovascular mortality, so the risk of dying from cardiovascular disease. So for those patients people who consume between 10 and 25% of their calories from added sugar, they had a 30% increase in cardiovascular death. And for those people who consume more than 25% of calories from added sugar, their risk nearly tripled. So, you know, where before we were concerned about, you know, if you had too much sugar, your teeth would rot out or you'd get fat. Well, now it seems it's more than just that. And it's what's important. It's not just increasing the risk of developing diabetes or increasing the risk of obesity. It was really an independent risk factor. So accounting for all those other risk factors, it still increased the risk.
So what are we talking about? Cupcakes and brownies or granular sugar?
What they said was it's the equivalent of the amount of sugar. Well, let's take a step back. So, again, it relates to how much – what percent of your daily calories are coming from added sugar. And this isn't the sugar that you have in an apple or the sugar you have, you know, in eating fruit. It's added sugar. So it's the sweetened beverages, the sugar-sweetened beverages that we're talking about. And the 15% mark, if you drink one 20-ounce Mountain Dew and a 2,000-calorie diet, that gives you that 15% of sugar. So that's not all that much. And what's interesting, though, what this comes to also, and the challenge has been that if we look at the amount of sodium that's recommended, there are U.S. recommendations, USDA recommendations for the amount of sodium you should have, for the amount of trans fats. There's really no recommendation for sugars. And so this is raising that question if we really need to have that kind of recommendation and some a little bit more restrictions on how this is marketed.
This brings to mind another problem potentially, and that is how do you know how much sugar you're getting? I mean, not everything has a big label on it saying
– well. But you need to look at labels. So if you look at the back label, it'll tell you how much of the percent. You know, if you look at the amount of sodium, what percent that should be in your diet. If you look at the amount of trans fats, it will tell you. But if you look at the amount of sugars, it's not clear how much because it's not. There's no specific recommendation. We do tell people though, try to keep that amount of percent of added sugars really less than 10%.
So are you saying when I look at a product and I see sodium at 3%, that is not telling me it's 3% sodium in this particular –
Well, it depends upon what you're looking at. Yeah. So it'll give you the number of milligrams of sodium. Yeah. And in general, we ask patients to limit the amount of sodium intake to typically less than 1,800 milligrams per day or less than 1,500 milligrams per day. But then the label will tell you the percent of sodium allowable based upon your – based upon the amount of sodium you should have in a given
day.
The
labels are really, really important, no question.
They are, and they're challenging sometimes to look at.
Yeah, let's take a call. Nina is joining us from South City. Nina, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Thank you for having this show. So about a year ago, I started having panic attacks. And what happens is when I have a panic attack, my blood pressure spikes really high, you know, 150, 160, 180 was the worst it ever went. And I'm thoroughly convinced I'm going to have a heart attack. So I've started taking medication for that, but I wanted to know, is there a link between, you know, panic attacks and your blood pressure spiking like that and heart disease?
So as far as the association between, say, panic attacks and cardiovascular disease, we do know there's an association between mental health and cardiovascular disease, and certainly depression is an important consideration in patients with cardiovascular disease. As far as panic attack actually leading to a heart attack, I don't think there's any specific data to suggest that. As far as blood pressure variations, certainly concerning. The main thing we tell our patients that when it comes to blood pressure, really your risk of cardiovascular disease relates to your blood pressure over the course of the day. So we tell people to really look at their blood pressure several times during the day. the best thing that you can probably do is address with your doctor exactly why you're having the panic attacks and kind of try to eliminate that as the nidus for your having hypertension.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Nina, thanks for the call. Dr. Cates, what are the socioeconomic components to this?
You know, it's interesting. As we look, there are potentially socioeconomic implications related to diet and the effects on cardiovascular disease. There are also racial disparities that we can see as well in the way that cardiovascular disease manifests in different patient populations. When it comes to the effects of socioeconomic status on diet, that's one of the key issues too as we look at the effects of fast food and sugar-sweetened cereals and sugar-sweetened beverages and the amount of sodium in processed foods also. And that does weigh in on the risk of cardiovascular disease.
So you mentioned racial and ethnic differences. What are some of those? Are some obviously at more greater risk than others?
There are. And so if we look at the incidence of, say, hypertension, we know that hypertension tends to affect African Americans more frequently than whites. If we look at the incidence of obesity, especially in Mexican Americans, we see higher incidence of obesity in Mexican Americans. And also the way that, say, hypertension affects individuals. The recommendations for treating hypertension are slightly different in some ways for African Americans as opposed to non-black patients, mm-hmm. with certain medications being better for that patient population.
This is a problem for a lot of people, at least at the present time. How often should a person go to a doctor and be checked out?
So when it comes to being checked out, meaning
for heart disease,
yeah. And so as part of any initial evaluation, I think an assessment of cardiovascular risk is appropriate. And with that, one of the new guidelines looking at cardiovascular risk made some very specific recommendations. And we do think that individuals, certainly by age 20, should be assessed, have their cholesterol evaluated, have their blood pressure evaluated, be screened for obesity. And in a healthy individual, probably every 5 years, it's reasonable to reassess cardiovascular risk. As far as seeing your primary care physician, I mean, it's reasonable annually to be at least seen by your primary care physician. For patients who are at higher risk for cardiovascular disease, then certainly an annual evaluation may be appropriate.
Well, how about symptoms? What should we be looking for that could be a tip-off?
So that's one of the important things to keep in mind also. We've been talking a lot more about cardiovascular risk, and that applies in general to the asymptomatic patients, so people who don't have symptoms that are concerned about their risk and what risk factors to look for. But for those patients who may have symptoms, that's equally important. When it comes to knowing the signs for a heart attack, you know, we tell patients that symptoms to look for would be chest pain or chest pressure or tightness, and those symptoms that just don't go away. So chest pain that happens, especially at rest, that goes on for 20 minutes or 30 minutes, or if they've seen a progression in symptoms like that, those are symptoms that worry us. Those are symptoms more of a heart attack, and that requires immediate attention and calling 911 to be brought to the emergency room and be assessed, even be assessed en route. It's also important to know the signs of angina. So angina, which may be a precursor to a heart attack, can be a little bit more subtle. Patients can have symptoms of chest discomfort with exertion. It may get progressively worse over time. They may have chest tightness. They may have indigestion. In women, the symptoms can be different sometimes. Now, symptoms can be similar, but they may have different symptoms. The symptoms can be nausea. They may be fatigue, shortness of breath, but they may be a little bit more subtle. Mm-hmm. So knowing those symptoms can be helpful. Most important, again, knowing the symptoms of a sudden heart attack, and that's the classic chest pain symptoms for the majority of people. But knowing that if you do think you're having a heart attack, the thing to do is to call 911 for many different reasons. One is that you can be assessed immediately by an EMT, by a paramedic who can see if you're having a heart attack or not and take you to the appropriate hospital. They can also start therapy en route. And importantly, too, a certain percentage don't survive long enough to get to the hospital. Mm-hmm. And if you're in an ambulance, you may have a chance of surviving. But if you're driving, then you won't.
The key is knowing your own body. And if you're feeling something that's quite different,
it's worth checking out. Now, some patients get frustrated because they may have symptoms and they get a reasonable evaluation. They still have symptoms. And sometimes it's not your heart, but it's always reasonable to be checked out.
We have an email here from Anne that I'd like to have you respond to. Can heart disease be reversed by diet and lifestyle changes as suggested by Dean Ornish and others?
Yeah. So as far as trying to reverse heart disease, I think we can certainly control it well. As we said before, there are a number of risk factors that are very modifiable, very treatable, and as it relates to diet and exercise. As far as the effects of, you know, Dr. Ornish's diet, I think the data for that is a little bit limited. He did some studies looking at the effects on plaque, on coronary artery plaque as it relates to diet, and there are a few other studies looking at some medications on the effect of plaque, and those are really difficult to say based if we really see regression of plaque or not. But what I do think is the risk factors that patients have can be very strongly affected by exercise and diet.
What is your diet like?
Thank you for asking. Did my wife put you up to this? So we try to eat a balanced diet, a diet that involves, you know, having fish at least once or twice a week. You know, balanced as it relates to a modest amount of meat and a reasonable chicken intake also. And then I probably admittedly eat a few more carbs than I should, and a glass of red wine a day.
But you're doing a lot of exercise.
I do, right.
You're in pretty good shape.
So I do think, and we talk to patients about this also, and, you know, the importance of practicing what you preach. But I think exercise certainly is a key part of daily activity.
What is a silent heart attack?
So a silent heart attack is a can be identified later on in patients. So if somebody that we evaluate for various reasons in the office, if we can see either on an echocardiogram or an ECG evidence of a prior heart attack, that's something that we would invoke as being a silent heart attack. we see that in roughly maybe a third to even sometimes half of patients can have what you call a silent heart attack. We tend not to focus as much on that. Many of those patients, though, do have potential reversible risk factors as it relates to that.
I gather that there has been a significant progress in surgical techniques with regard to heart disease.
And so as it relates to several different areas, we've seen some advances in both in surgery and percutaneous treatment of cardiovascular disease. One thing we've been very involved with at WashU is the use of percutaneous valve replacement. So actually a combined effort of our surgeons and our interventional cardiologists for valve replacement, something I think we talked about last year, our partners trial, which we were involved with, which took patients who had aortic stenosis and giving them a percutaneous aortic valve resulted in significant improvement for our patients who are older and patients who are high-risk candidates.
And the invasive nature of some of these surgeries really has been diminished, hasn't it?
It has, yeah.
Getting back to the sugar situation, the predominance of artificial sweeteners is pretty noticeable these days. They're heavily advertised and heavily used. Are they really any different than sugar?
Well, they are. If we look at the data as it relates to the various sugars that are there, the naturally occurring sugars versus the processed sugars, the risk of cardiovascular disease, the risk of diabetes, of obesity, is really related to the use of the artificial sugars. So the sugars that are used for the sweetened beverages, the use of sugars and even in yogurts that are artificial sugars, those do increase the risk as opposed to natural occurring sugars that we see in fruits and in vegetables.
I'm glad you mentioned fruits and vegetables again, because there's a lot of sugar in the fruits that we're told to eat, and you said that is not a problem. Why not?
Well, the way I think our body handles those sugars is different. The way we respond, our metabolism, the way insulin is secreted in response to those sugars is different, and the way they're stored is different than the artificial sweeteners. And I think along the lines of diet, I think it's worth mentioning with the new guidelines that came out too, for the first time, I think we have decent recommendations for the benefits of diet on treating cholesterol and on treating blood pressure. So eating a healthy diet, and we can address that in a minute, but eating a healthy diet really can help lower LDL, help lower the bad cholesterol, and it can help lower blood pressure. So I mean, the diets we think about are diets that are rich in fruits and vegetables and whole grains. Really low-fat dairy products are important. Limiting the number of sweets and sugar-sweetened beverages and limiting the amount of red meats. those are important. And the diet that can be treated, there's several different diets available. There's this diet called the DASH diet, which is the Dietary Advice to Stop Hypertension diet, which is available on the web, on the internet. AHA has a diet that's recommended also that relates to the DASH diet as well too. Those are the types of things that can be helpful for both treating lowering LDL and lowering lowering blood pressure too. And I do think what's important, and we were talking about this before, that with kids especially, when it comes to drinking soda, especially the sugar, the sweetened sugar sodas, as they develop a taste for that early, it's challenging to eliminate that taste later. But also realize that for kids who are drinking that, they're not drinking good things that they should be, milk and juice and water.
We're going to have to wrap this up, but there is a diet-related email we have here from Lynn. What's the doctor's opinion of the role of diet-induced systemic acidosis in the development or aggravation of heart disease?
Say that again, please.
The role of diet-induced systemic acidosis in the development of heart disease.
So what I think Lynn is getting at, and certainly with some of the diets that have been put out over the last several years, including Atkins diet and others, the nature of those diets is to induce an acidosis, which really helps stimulate weight loss. I think what we've learned from many studies looking at various diet plans is that they're not successful because they're not maintainable, and the amount of weight that's lost is similar to a diet like the DASH diet or the Mediterranean-style diet. So I don't advocate that as a good means to lose weight and certainly sustain weight loss.
Kind of have to wrap it up at that point, Doctor. Thank you so much for being with us. It's Dr. Andrew Cates, Washington University cardiologist at Barnes Jewish Hospital. Next, what the archaeologists found during construction of the new Mississippi River Bridge. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.